You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Robert Bound, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, how do you portray the master of film and the medium he knew so well? We'll be discussing two very different versions of Hitchcock with critic Tim Robey.
All of us harbour dark recesses of violence and horror. I'm just a man hiding in the corner with a camera, watching.
We're shuddering in here. We'll also be joined by Fred Deakin, graphic designer, DJ, and former member of Lemon Jelly, to talk us through some vinyl he's been digging around to discover.
Oh, makes me tell you, oh girl, yeah. You know you're gonna hurt yourself. Hey. You know you're gonna hurt yourself.
And the ever-charming theatre critic Matt Wolfe will be here to talk about how two very different stars of the screen, Kirsten Scott Thomas and Rowan Atkinson, fare on the London stage.
So much to look forward to this week live on The Review, here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House on Saturday. Hello, Rob.
To you and me, Gillian. It's the dream team.
I know, on a Saturday, on the weekend. I
don't know whether this dynamic duo has been formed before in anger on a Saturday morning, right?
Right.
It's all fresh.
No, yeah, fresh. First
Do you feel
time.
Fresh?
We're virgins.
I know, exactly. We're as pure as the clean driven snow. At this point in the show, we talk about our cultural weeks, I've heard.
Yes. Yes, well,
come
you're
on,
used
dare
to
me.
Do,
dare you, me to you, tell you.
You're used to seeing culture like non-stop for your culture show. But I dipped into the Royal Opera House yesterday to see the most stunning ballet production of Unagin. So a nice way to sort of turn the volume down on a crazy week at work.
Indeed. You've done culture with a capital C there, I think.
A capital C. And it was breathtakingly beautiful, I have to say.
And did it fit the bill? Was it a nice chilled end to your week?
It was, because there's something about, you know, with our job, we're always talking to people, we're always listening, we're always reading, and suddenly, you know, you have this just music and the most beautiful dancers and choreography, and in the set is Eugen Onegin, so it's this almost like a painting of period Russia with choreography that I was reading someone describe it as psychology and a mix of psychology and steps, and so you're just completely drawn in, and for that whole time you don't think about problems, you don't think about work, you don't think about anything.
Nice. Is it sort of quite a traditional staging of it, or is it kind of?
It is. It was original staging.
It's not like done in an office and everyone's wearing suits.
No, it's not like Lineborn when they contemporize all these period pieces. But actually, the choreographer for a classical ballet, the choreography for a classical ballet is quite contemporary because it was choreographed in 65. But it has these just beautiful period sets. But the dancing is, in a way, for classical, quite modern. And the pas de deux are just sublimely exquisite.
Sublimely exquisite.
And they were danced by
they
were danced by a prima ballerina who is Argentinian, and her partner is her husband, who's Brazilian, and it was just so sensual. It was just wonderful. So what
I think
about
you? Stop
what
that.
About
Let's
you?
Stop right there. I'm going to Google that. I want to see that in slow motion. I want to see that sensuality in slow motion. I had a good week, despite the fact it was production week for the magazine, which tends to keep us chained fairly close to our desks. I nipped out and saw the new Françoise Ozon film called In the House, which is amazing. We might be talking about that later with Tim Robey, possibly. He's going to be our first guest on the show. And also reviewing books for the magazine. Finished James Wood's great book called The Fun Stuff, which is a collection. He's a New Yorker writer. It's a collection of his essays on everything from W.G. Sebald to baseball. It's really, really great. Really,
and are
really
we
going
to be hearing about that on your culture show on Monday?
Possibly. I could put in a plug for that. I don't need to plug the culture show, do I? I could do. We could do it. Sometimes, do you know what? Sometimes it comes to that, the sister show. Sometimes it comes to that point on a Saturday morning where you can't quite remember what you've done, what's going to be in the culture show. So we'll have to move swiftly. We'll have to move swiftly along from Gillian DeBias's Onegin Culture with a capital C to my slightly rougher stuff. You're tuned in to The Review, coming to you live from Studio One. Coming up next, we'll be speaking to Tim Robey about Hitchcock. And it is. First up, it is film time, and more specifically, films about films and filmmakers. How very meta. The famous silhouette up for discussion today is that of Alfred Hitchcock. He of the cameo, he of the tent-like suit, the notorious blonde fancier himself.
Two films have been in the spotlight of late. The Girl, a portrayal of the relationship between Hitchcock, played by Toby Jones, and his leading lady of the birds, T.B. Hedren. The second, out yesterday here in London, is simply called Hitchcock, and it's a more Hollywood affair. Anthony Hopkins playing the director as he struggles to get a funny little horror movie called Psycho funded and made against slightly surprising odds.
And joining us to shout action on set and discuss these two differing accounts, the great man is Tim Robey, film critic for the Daily Telegraph here in London. Two Hitchcocks, two quite different films.
Yeah, they're interesting contrasts, yeah. There, I think, because people may have seen the Toby Jones one on telly over Christmas. That's the one which is basically about how terrible he treated Tippi Hedren on the set of The Birds and Marnie, and it pretty much depicts him as a sex pest, and you don't really get much of the kind of genius of Hitchcock in that one. And this one is actually a much rather lighter-hearted film, I think. It's more cartoonish and kind of caricatured in a way.
Yeah, it does seem to be. And even the post, actually, coming on the tube on the way down here this morning, having seen the film in the week, the posters are quite cartoonish. It's done as a kind of, it's a pastiche of a Hitchcock poster, I guess.
Yeah, it kind of kicks off from Hitchcock's own kind of slight self-parody element where he used to come on and do his kind of routine on telly with his kind of lugubrious voice coming on. And we get that at the beginning of this film. He kind of presents the film to us in the same sort of way.
Why now do you think we're getting two productions about Hitchcock so close together?
Well, there's been a lot of Hitchcock stuff in the works recently. Last summer, the BFI showed all of his films, and Vertigo actually won the poll of the top best film of all time at Sight and Sound. So there's a lot of sort of Hitchcock. There's a sort of sense in which we're celebrating the 50 years after his kind of great films. But it's strange that these two have come along at exactly the same moment, and they both, in different ways, kind of delve into his darker side too. And particularly his kind of obsessiveness and his the way he treated actresses, which is quite notorious, particularly Tippi Hedren. In Hitchcock, he's actually got a very nice relationship with Scarlett Johansson, who plays Janet Leigh on the set of Psycho. But it focuses more on his relationship with his wife, Helen Mirren, who plays Alma. And this brings out an aspect of Hitchcock that we don't necessarily know that much about, which is his collaboration with his wife. She was a very important creative partner for him throughout his working career.
Yeah, they both have quite strong sort of female entitlement. They have sort of, there's quite a lot of female emancipation in these movies, strangely enough, right?
Yeah, there's a hint in Hitchcock as well that Alma might have been straying from the path herself. There's a sort of hint of infidelity with this friend of hers, which is not, I mean, some biographers think that happens, some don't. And the film toys with it, but it plays with it in Hitchcock's own head. He's suspicious that she might be being unfaithful to him. So it becomes a kind of Hitchcock film in a way about his suspicion, because, like Notorious or something, with Claude Rains worrying about what's going on between Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant. We get the same thing with Hitchcock in that.
And also, both of these films are just interesting to watch actors playing actors. Not just playing well-known people, but playing actors themselves. Scarlett Johansson plays Janet Leigh in the more Hollywood version, maybe, and the HBO-BBC co-production, The Girl.
Sienna Miller.
I knew I should have written it down. Sienna Miller plays Tippi Hedren, and they're pretty good performances, I think. Right?
I think so. I also really like James Darcy, who plays Anthony Perkins in Hitchcock. He does a great job of Anthony Perkins. His sort of slightly neurotic quality comes right through. We could have focused a bit more on him, actually, and on the set, on the stuff on the set of Psycho, but I think the director of Hitchcock wanted to take it away from that and to explore the marriage more, because that's one side of Hitchcock I say we don't know that much about. So Hopkins and Mirren together as a team, that's the centre of this film.
I haven't seen either of them yet. I'm going to see one of them this afternoon, but I'd be interested from the two of you. You have Toby Jones and you have Anthony Hopkins both playing Hitchcock. All right, so what did you think? How do they compare and contrast? What are their interpretations of this amazing?
I don't know about you. I think Toby Jones is slightly trapped into only being able to play Hitchcock one way, which is that he's a monster.
Yeah.
And he's sort of on the set of The Birds and he's kind of enjoying the sadism of subjecting his actress to this treatment. So he becomes someone who's slightly sort of unbearable and you wouldn't really want to shake his hand, really. But
no, it's a strange thing. And he really reminds me, and his Hitchcock strangely really reminds me of his role in Peter Strickland's Barbarian Sound Studio.
That's right.
He's got such a character actor's face, Toby Jones, and he's such a wonderful actor, but he does seem to be it's sort of in a sort of situation beyond his control in both those films.
And it's weird. On a side note, he always seems to pop up playing someone who someone else has just played. So when a few years ago when they made Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman. We had our Toby Jones Capote film as well, Infamous. So he sort of pops up, and he always does a really good job. I think Hopkins does a much broader and funnier kind of portrait, and he kind of nails the voice really well. It's like old school Hopkins. It's like reminds you of this is what I actually interviewed the director, and he was talking about this. It reminds you of Hopkins doing Nixon in Nixon, or Hopkins doing Shadowlands and doing these kind of biographical portraits.
Do you know what we're going to have? We forgot to do this. We're going to play some clips from these films so that people can... We'll do the compare and contrast. We'll now do it.
Let's do it.
In an audio way.
All of us harbour dark recesses of violence and horror. I'm just a man hiding in the corner with a camera, watching.
Mr. Hitchcock, you're the most famous director in the history of the medium, but you're 60 years old.
Shouldn't you just quit while you're ahead?
This is murder. I'm getting blisters just watching you.
He's going out of his mind looking for his next project.
I need something fresh, something different.
And that was a clip from Hitchcock, the Sacha Gervaisi, Anthony Hopkins, Helen Mirren efforts. And now we're going to hear the HBO-BBC co-production.
The Birds is coming. My most ambitious movie ever. To Alfie and Tippy.
I'll be putty in your hands.
Action.
It's like he wants to get inside. I have to be a professional. I have to do my job.
Don't you think it's time you gave something back?
I'm the only one who could stop it with one word.
I love you.
The Syrupy Strings there of The Girl, which is the BBC HBO co-production. I wanted to ask you, having interviewed Sacha Gervaisi, the director of the Hitchcock and the Hollywood version, what's it like? I wonder what you felt about sort of, it must be a kind of big carte blanche for a director to do something about such another sort of presumably hero of his.
Yeah, I think what he wanted to do was show an unexplored side of him. So his view was that Hitchcock has been over-lionized in a way as this great artist and sort of, you know, this huge titanic figure in film history. And at the same time, he's also been sort of over-demonized as this kind of creepy voyeur who kind of wanted to turn all of his actresses into this blonde sort of sculpture. He thinks that both those aspects of Hitchcock maybe have been overstressed. So what he wants to bring out was not only the importance of his partnership with his wife, the Helen Mirren character, but also the fact that Hitchcock was actually very playful. He was an entertainer. And even though we might hail him now as a great artist who's created all these great films, at the time he really just wanted to entertain audiences, and that was his main focus. And he wanted to do so kind of very playfully and kind of very mischievously. So there's a kind of mischief to this one, which I think I quite enjoy.
And it's a much more likeable character. The Hopkins Hitchcock is a much more likeable character.
Yeah, although you do get hints of how he might have mistreated certain people in his life. The character played by Jessica Biel, she plays Vera Miles, who is an actress who starred for Hitchcock in The Wrong Man and then played the fairly subsidiary role of Janet Leigh's sister in Psycho. And she was supposed to be cast in Vertigo originally, which was a couple of years before Psycho, but she got pregnant and a couple of weeks before they were shooting, and she basically had to bail out from the production. And Hitchcock really never forgave her. And you actually get that the sense of that in their relationship in Hitchcock, that she's massively disappointed him. And she's just one of a long line of actresses like Ingrid Bergman and Grace Kelly, who were briefly his shining stars and then went off and did their own thing, went to Europe, got married, eloped or whatever, and didn't continue their careers with him. And he was always sort of bitterly betrayed by these women.
How has Hollywood responded to the Anthony Hopkins Hitchcock version? They're often very protective of films about their industry.
Yeah, I don't know if it's been the kind of big awardsy success that they probably hoped it might be. Helen Mirren got a BAFTA nomination, I think, but not an Oscar nomination. And Hopkins hasn't been nominated. I think people perhaps think it's too much of a sort of spoof of Hitchcock in a way, that they haven't taken it that seriously. And I don't think it is really meant to be taken that seriously. I think it's quite a playful film, and it does just bring up the sort of lighter side of Hitchcock in a way. So I think probably investing it with too much importance would have been a mistake.
Let's touch on the style of these two films as well. It's one of those, when I watched the BBC version at Christmas, I was expecting a bit more oomph with the direction. I was expecting it to do things, ape some Hitchcock moves, do something a little bit more interesting. And again, with the Sacha Gervaisi one, I was kind of wanting it to kind of pastiche to do something clever and reference the films more than maybe they did.
They do a little bit. I mean, in The Girl, when Tippi Hedren is being attacked in the phone booth during the birds, the shoot of the birds, it's almost like the shower cubicle, right? He shoots it from above. It's like she's being sort of stabbed by birds. So it's sort of a Psycho reference in there. And actually in Hitchcock, they're relatively subtle, but there are a bunch of little sort of pastiches and little homages throughout it. For instance, there's a sequence where Hopkins, who, as I say, is very suspicious that his wife's having this affair, he finds all this sand on the bathroom floor, which is a clue that she's been on the beach possibly with her lover. And that's definitely a direct reference to Notorious, where Claude Rains finds this sort of black silt in the cellar, which is a clue that his wife has been meddling around with the uranium he's been hiding. So it's like he's definitely bringing up these resonances a little bit. But
and he puts it in a vial, doesn't he? And he presents it to her, which is really...
Yeah.
Without giving too much away, the shower sequence is so iconic. Do you think they handle that well?
Yeah, this is obviously handled in the Hollywood version, because it's about the making of Psycho, and I think they do it really well. We don't want to spoil the reveal, but it's very much hands-on direction from Hitchcock, isn't it? In that scene, and that they get the final take. Only when he kind of takes matters into his own hands, right?
That's right. I like Scarlett Johansson, actually, who plays Janet Leigh, and she kind of makes, when they're talking about the production, she sort of says, how are you going to shoot this Hitch, you know, because I'm not under-endowed up here, you know, you've got to be careful with what you're going to show.
Tim Robey does a great Scarlett Johansson impersonation, by the way. You're wasted on the radio. And he freaks her out.
Yeah, he does. And then during the scene, he's at his most kind of paranoid about what else might be going on with other people in his life. So it kind of imagines it as a fantasy of him stabbing lots of different people. It actually this film kind of depicts Hitchcock as a bit of a Norman Bates figure, that he's the one who's kind of going a bit nuts mentally. And, you know, that's where we get less of Anthony Perkins, I think. I would have liked to see a bit more of him.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. He was great, and you kind of do want to see a bit more. I want to go and rewatch both those films now.
I'm going to this afternoon.
Let's do it again. Tim Robey from The Daily Telegraph, thank you so much for joining us to talk through Hitchcock. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we're going to have the weekend look ahead.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Robert Bound. And now it's that time in the show we hand over to our associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, to hear all about the cultural treats on offer around the world this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
This weekend in Tokyo, stop by Chanel Nexus Hall in Ginza, where on display are 54 of the best works of French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson. Entitled The Mind's Eye, the retrospective of original prints taken between 1930 and 1970 is curated by the Henri Cartier-Bresson Foundation in Paris, and it will be on until the 10th of February. Now available on DVD is The Man with the Jazz Guitar, a music documentary about British jazz musician and radio broadcaster Ken Sikora. This animated documentary with a soundtrack of superb recordings makes a perfect choice for a feel-good weekend film. London Design Museum's exhibition, Extraordinary Stories About Ordinary Things, is showcasing key designs that have shaped the modern world. Make sure you check out Tatsuno Otoshigo, a foldable lampshade created by Japanese designer Issei Miyake for Italian lighting brand Artemide. Other objects on display include Britain's iconic red phone box and Jasper Morrison Handel bar table. For more information, go to designmuseum.org. From this weekend onwards, the Northern Lichtfotter Gallery in Groningen, in the Netherlands, will be hosting In This Land, a new project about Israel by celebrated photographer and Monocle contributor Zed Nelson. Nelson made a series of visits to the country, focusing his images not on the well-documented aggression in the region, but instead on how the land itself is so deeply embedded in the identity of its people. In This Land is on until the 17th of March. And for your soundtrack this weekend, we suggest The Flower Lane by DuckTales, the alter ego of Matt Mondenail of New Jersey pop act Real Estate. Let's hear Assistant Director. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
And that ended with the sound of Assistant Director by DuckTales from her new album, The Flower Lane. And before that, you heard Nelly Gotcheva. Up next, it's more music. We're joined in the studio by Fred Deakin.
Hello.
To quote the Smiths, the honour and the privilege is mine.
You flatter me,
and
sir.
Mine.
Oh, well, you flatter
I should
me,
say the pleasure and the privilege. They can't misquote the Smiths. What's wrong with me?
Well, then it's early.
I should read the intro
you
that's been written for me.
The
exactly.
Man in front of us.
Known in equal parts for his graphic design work as his staggeringly eclectic DJ sets, but perhaps you may know him best as half of pioneering electro act Lemon Jelly, who bestrode the noughties like a surreal musical colossus.
Wow, I'm blushing and I feel taller already.
Welcome to the review, Fred.
Thank you for having me.
And you thrust something into our hands.
I did indeed.
Sat down.
Yes.
We're going to come to that later. Okay. This is a small thing. It looks like a CD. If I were to unwrap it, I know it's a secret, but if I were to unwrap it, I would say it's a CD.
I think you might be right. I don't want to spoil the surprise too much. but especially since I want to talk about vinyl.
Exactly.
How much nicer vinyl is than
we
CD.
We want to talk about slightly larger, maybe flimsier discs.
Indeed.
The hunt for vinyl goes on, Fred.
It certainly does. Well, I'm always looking. I'm addicted to buying secondhand vinyl, and I had to actually ban myself. I had to have a Lent period before Christmas where I said, you cannot. I gave up charity shop records and I gave up chocolate. So that was a double whammy for 3 months.
Yeah. I wouldn't call charity shops a sin, though.
Well, I know what you're saying, but the problem is you're holding a thing in a charity shop and you go, well, should I buy this or shouldn't I buy this? And then a little voice goes, go on, it's for charity.
Yeah.
You're doing something for charity, giving something back. And I end up with some terrible records and books as a result that I shouldn't have bought in the first place. But the quest goes on, and I think that vinyl has certainly kind of re-emerged as the primary format for music almost for the under-25s, or certainly for the 18 to 25s living in East London. A friend of mine who sells second-hand turntables.
Did you roll your eyes then? You just rolled your eyes.
I did a little bit, yeah. Okay, I'll own that. I think you probably heard me roll my eyes in my voice there as well, didn't you? But Yeah, and I'm actually very happy because I always thought the CD was a horrible format, even though I have been responsible for some CDs coming out. I always try and make my CDs, the packaging, I try and make it look as much like vinyl as possible, and so make it very tangible. I hate plastic jewel cases because they're basically designed to make as much money as possible out of a repeatable
I'm thinking about those lovely covers for KY and for Lost Horizons, beautiful things that needed to be seen in vinyl form. I'm making an arm as if I'm carrying something huge here.
But they were triple gatefold, so yeah, beautiful things. All the way,
yeah. And is that one of the things as well? The cover art obviously has always been very important to you. Is that something, do you buy with your, when you're in a charity shop, do you buy with your eyes?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm definitely looking, flicking through a box of records is a completely different experience from flicking through a CD wallet or scanning an iTunes menu. It's a much more visceral experience. And that kind of flows into DJing as well. And there's some clubs coming out now where they only say, we haven't got CD decks, we haven't got laptops, we only let you play vinyl. And when I'm DJing, I'm drawn visually to where I'm going because it's a much richer experience, I think. And I think that's the challenge for online music, I think, now. It's a massive gap, is to restore that depth of experience. Because we all used to sit in our rooms, you know, slightly altered in a pleasant way and enjoying the depth of music on our headphones with our friends. And I'm not sure that happens anymore.
And the best way to choose stuff is still to look at the spines, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But also finding it. You know, if you're online and you're just downloading things, you sort of lose the pleasure of what you're saying, the hunt. So you go around and you look in different things, and wherever you are in the world, it's a bit of a treasure hunt. So it's the process of searching and the satisfaction of finding something.
Absolutely. And that trail is such a kind of there's a kind of Zen state to it as well. When you kind of some days you just don't find anything you want, and then one day, you know, the last record in the box is the thing you've been looking for all day. You make friends with people. Sometimes you sense that someone's collection has come all together, and you kind of go, well, if this one's good, then the ones around it might be good as well. And it's like all these kind of energy patterns that you just don't really get, I think, online. You're always responding to someone else's curation when you're looking online, really, rather than discovering for yourself.
It's an interesting idea, the idea of energy patterns. I think you're absolutely right. Whether it's someone else's thumbprints on the vinyl itself, you know.
Well, it's a real visceral thing.
Yeah, coffee mug stains.
Exactly. The things that we've done, you're sitting there holding the record sleeve, pulling out the inner sleeve. You can totally immerse yourself in it in a way that you just don't when you're sitting at a laptop.
Well, we're going to play a track, I think. Well, we're going to ruminate on how best to find vinyl.
Sounds
and how
good.
You also give it away using the old devil digital.
Yeah.
But what's the first track you've chosen for us?
Well, the first track is by Frankie Valli, and he's quite a mainstream chap, and I've learned over the years that you have to explore. And I came to Frankie Valli, the first track that I kind of went, oh, yeah, actually, that's quite good, was the cheesy Oh What a Night. That was late December back in 63.
Yeah.
And then I found The Night, which is a fantastic Northern Soul stomper. And then they did Paluski, the Paris DJ, did an edit of Beggin'. And I thought, okay, three killers. There must be more. So I went looking, and I found this.
Oh, makes me tell you, oh girl, yeah, you know you're gonna hurt yourself.
Hey,
you know you're gonna hurt yourself when you're broken, worn out, when your heart is torn out. Don't call me, don't wait till it's too late.
Sound of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, as chosen by Fred Deakin on the review here on Monocle 24. Fred's with us.
Hello.
He's not spinning it because he's in here. He's not over there through the other side of the glass.
Next time
I bet he wishes he was.
Next time I'll bring my little turntable and we'll do it live. I'll scratch it up for you.
Exactly. And where did you find that one?
I found that in a charity shop. It was one of the huge pile I had to go through in order to justify being able to go back after my Lent period, basically. I've been processing for the last month or so. And, you know, it's a full-time job, I'll be honest with you. I don't know quite how I'm going to go. There's still crates of it left. I've got about a week to go.
Nice. So. And with that, and do you get a kind of warm, fuzzy feeling? Do you have the alacrity of discovery when you find something like that?
Absolutely.
And it could be, I mean, was that off an album or a Northern Soul sort of compilation? Or
that was off an album that just had a big picture of Frankie on the front with a kind of frame around him. And he's kind of very mafioso. He's quite a Sinatra style with the big rings and everything. Past the point when he was a lithe young chap recording that actual record himself. But it was kind of like, I am the Don and you will listen to my album. And I thought,
and it sucked you in.
You're coming out with me, I thought, when I saw it. Yeah, with the gatefold, you pull it out and the frame stays and the picture comes out. And it's like, oh, reveal.
And that's got a very sort of much more mellifluous, softer quality to the, as you said, to the stompy stuff.
Absolutely, but it's still got a really nice backbeat. And I was playing it out in East London on Saturday. Saturday night to a crowd that had definitely never heard it before, and they all jumped up and down. So it's got a nice kind of swing, stroll around the room, you know.
That must be great to see people respond to something like an old favourite of yours and people who hear it for the first time.
Yes, absolutely. And, it's the pure joy of DJing, and I've DJed since I was a teenager, and there's nothing better than thinking, oh, I love this record, will they love it?
Yeah.
And playing it, and the dance floor just goes, and you go, yes, I made that connection.
Nice. I put Ramblin' Man on last night at a party. Oh. Had the same effect.
There we go.
Exactly.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I owe you PRS on
that. It was in a house. It's fine.
Okay. All right, then.
And I think we'll head on to the next track. And then we're going to talk about, I think, about how you share some of your music.
Sure.
And give it back to people via Twitter. But what's the next track you've got for us?
Well, this one's a bit controversial, I'll be honest. There's a whole kind of boom in the soft rock MOR standards at the moment. There's rumours that the new Daft Punk album is going to have two tracks written by Paul Williams, a famous West Coast songwriter. He wrote Rainy Days and Mondays for the Carpenters, and of course We've Only Just Begun, which is probably the best wedding tune ever written. If you want a first dance, We've Only Just Begun is the one. And again, East London is very much part of that, and obviously with Lemon Jelly, we put out that soft rock Chicago bootleg about 10 years ago, so I claim a little bit of credit. And yeah, I've had to go right into that kind of devil's area of West Coast MOR to find the nuggets. And I think this is one, but it's right on the edge of the cheese. Because it's Rupert Holmes, whose big hit is the Pina Colada song. Yeah. Do you like Pina Colada? I'm going to walk in the rain.
I was about to say, I feel basically, this sound like you should have your smart jacket on, maybe in a pastel shade, with the sleeves rolled up.
Absolutely. Just imagine me like that, listeners, as we give you, off the same album of the Pina Colada song, this is Rupert Holmes with Answering Machine.
And I said, baby, let's go get married. Oh, I need to know your mind. I am hanging on, I am hanging on, I am hanging on this line. And if I can leave one message before you go to bed, I would say to you, and the phone went dead. So I stepped out to buy some dog food for the cat.
Answering Machine, Rupert Holmes. I think that Fred Deacon was taking full advantage of what was probably quite new technology then.
I think so. It's quite modern, isn't it?
The sound effects we love.
And that is lovely. So you're okay with that? That's just the right side of cheese.
I think it's right on the edge and looking over. But this is the first time I've
shared it.
It's a bit
of Steely Dan, and then a bit of really Gorgonzola.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Barry Manilow would have liked that one, I think. Yeah. But it's funky. You can't argue with that bass, you know.
Well, we should come to this. It's the phrase that's done the rounds a bit with the guilty pleasures circuit.
Yes.
Where do you stand on that? Do you like that phrase, or do you feel that it is a bit of a tiresome one?
Well, I think it's a shame in many ways. I mean, I'm a big fan of Sean, and I think he did a great thing, and it kind of did open a lot of people's tastes.
Yeah. This is the club night that goes by the name.
Yes, absolutely. Sean Riley's club night, Guilty Pleasures, absolutely. And I think, you know, he did a great thing in kind of overcoming a lot of the snobbery around this kind of music, because I think we do have to relax and leave our cool at the door sometimes. Mm. You know, it's all very well to, you know, the cutting edge is great, and I like to visit there as well. But yeah, there is a problem that it then becomes an excuse to play rubbish. And I've certainly occasionally fallen over the edge on that. And people, I'll play a night and I'll play, you know, credible, interesting music all night, and then I'll play one guilty pleasure, as it were, at the end, and people go, oh, he was playing that all night. You get kind of tarred with that brush.
So for those of you just joining us, exactly. Yeah. I know, it's a weird one. And I guess it's that thing where sort of guilty pleasures turns into school disco, and suddenly everyone's sort of got a tie wrapped around their head and they're thrashing along to Bon Jovi.
The fact of the matter is, it's very hard to do it well, and it's very easy to do it badly. And a lot of people went, oh, right, play rubbish, I can do that. Mm. And then kind of devalued what Sean, I think, did very well. So,
but Gillian's bias here is a fan of guilty pleasures. Sometimes I walk past her desk and I hear what's coming out of her headphones.
Guilty pleasures in music or in life?
I didn't mean it like that.
My goodness.
Indeed. And we wanted to talk about not only collecting records, but giving them back out again. And you have a unique way of doing this.
I do indeed. On my Twitter feed, which is Fred Deacon, I am giving away an old record every week, because I'm flicking through so many archives and charity shops and junk shops and wherever around the world. And I often find doubles of records that I love. Going for like a quid or a euro or whatever. Yeah. And I just can't leave them behind. It's like little orphans, you know. Why, you're unloved. Come with me to my orphanage and I will find adopted parents for you. And
so then what do you do?
On Twitter, I say, I've got this record and who wants it? And who, you know, best,
you just send
best, best tweet gets it.
Best tweet gets
but
it.
But you know what? I have another idea. I think you should run your own charity shop. I think you should have mixing booths.
My wife
think
is going to have a real word with
you
afterwards.
I think you should, you know, so people can come to the charity shop. They can hear it. You know, it's like sampling it.
Well, I'll tell you what I used to do. I used to do a swap shop. I used to go into record shops and just stand behind the counter and go, right, I've got this record. Who wants? Who will give me, you know, give me a Mars bar for this record or whatever? So, but that running my own charity shop, who knows?
So you can hear it
in a few years' time. I go, yeah. That's not a bad idea, actually. Yeah.
Don't imagine that though. People walking past, he used to be in Lemon Jelly. He's gone to seed.
Go on. There's only 99p kiddies. I got the first. I'll sign it.
I think we might have another. I think we're going to have another track. Your third and final.
My third and final track. Yeah. Well, this one's actually quite well known to those that explore these areas, but. I dismissed it for a while. It's Holger Kazuke from Cannes, and Cannes are kind of famous for this heads-down, brutal kind of kraut rock, and revered, quite rightly, for an amazing body of work. And then Holger Kazuke made this solo album and clearly had a bit of time at the end of the session and made this ridiculous disco record called Cool in the Pool.
Wowee.
Yeah.
We love that.
Everything plus the kitchen sink is available on that record.
Absolutely.
You're going to have to back announce that, Fred, because I've lost my bit of paper.
That was Holger Kazuke, Cool in the Pool. And yeah, he really does go for it, doesn't he? He goes the extra mile.
It sort of reminded me of like Lilliput or like post-punk, even a bit of Delta 5.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. Like that lovely metronomic, kind of very simple drumming and that beat. Proper kind of, lovely stuff. I love that. I'm going to need to get that.
Yeah, well, it's fine to put out there.
I'm going to tweet you and then I can maybe... Yeah,
but now, talking about getting things, Rob and I have been given this beautiful little... It looks like a present. It's black and white. And
I hope you enjoy it. It's the album of my alter ego, Frank Eddy. And then in case... coincidentally, I don't know who Frank Eddy is, but his name is an anagram of Fred Deacon. So there may be some connection. Who knows? And, it's a little underground thing that I've just put out with a whole bunch of my mash-up-y tracks on it. So, yeah.
So when's it? Is it out now?
It's out now.
Guess it, 'cause it's a limited release, isn't it?
It's a limited release. Only 400 copies for the world. So, but it's available. Piccadilly Records is my online vinyl vendor of choice.
400 copies for the whole world.
And we have
blood will be spilt, Fred.
But when you say you're alter ego, what's it sound like?
It's quite Jelly-esque, but a bit more upbeat, I'd say. And then there's a lot of kind of found vocals on it. The music's all original, but then it's. I was playing a few tracks of it out on Saturday night, and people seemed to like it and jumped up and down to it. So,
this will find its way wandering quickly towards the Monocle playlist. I'm sure it'd be nice to get some of that on. And you mentioned Lemon Jelly. What can we possibly ask you about this?
Well,
all we want is one of those another beautiful sleeves with a beautiful record in it.
Yes. Well, I saw Nick the other day, and you know we're always talking about the jelly. And yes, not dead but sleeping.
Not dead but sleeping. All right, that's a good one. It's always felt like, I feel asking you like that, whether the Smiths are going to reform or something. I always feel like it's something that everyone always wants, and it's kind of
Well, it's nice that people want it. You know, it's great. And you know, we both got mortgages. I'm sure it'll happen. You know.
Different flavour of jelly.
I hope so. Yeah, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? We come back as raspberry jelly. That'd be quite interesting. Yeah.
And when for something like that, a project that's probably always in the back of your mind, lemon jelly is always, you know, thinking of things to decompartmentalise and stick in the lemon jelly kind of bit of your brain. Mm. How does that work from the samples and the beats and everything? Does that sort of always occupy a separate filing cabinet for you?
Looking for stuff, and I think one of the joys of my full-time hobby, which is flicking through all these old records, is you used to get incredible inspiration from it, so it really feeds into it. But you know, a curious mind, and it's funny what strikes you out of left field. I'm sure any creative spirit would agree. It's the random happy accidents that really fuel that sort of stuff.
And the warm, fuzzy feeling you get from finding records in every weird and wonderful place all over the world.
Indeed.
And we're going to have to leave it there, Fred.
Well, very nice to have you.
We could have done a two-hour special.
Well,
what I want to do is rehear these songs.
Well, I'll come back and see if I can top this selection. If you get me back, I'll push the cheese further and I'll push the madness further.
Yeah.
And we'll see if I can really just get your brains to explode next
time. German post-punk is always most welcome.
Lovely.
as his jacket sleeve rolled up, sort of AOR.
Oh, I can do the smooth as well. Don't you worry about that.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much to Fred Deakin for joining us on the review. Up next, we're going to be doing a city look ahead.
Time now to travel to Santiago to hear what's coming up in the coming days. Steve Bodson is here to guide us through the city's highlights for the weekend and the week ahead.
Debido a las presiones internacionales, Pinochet ha tenido que aceptar la campaña opositora.
Chile's National Cinema Institute, the Cineteca Nacional, is showing a retrospective of the best Chilean movies of 2012. One that hasn't been widely distributed, but looks quite good, is a new documentary about novelist Roberto Bolaño, featuring interviews with his friends and colleagues. The movie is called La Batalla Futura. It's the first part of a trilogy about the Chilean writer who died in 2003. Bolaño has become ever more famous since he died, and there seems to be growing interest in his life. The same festival of Chilean films also includes No, which recently garnered Chile's first ever Oscar nomination. You can see the films at the La Moneda Cultural Center, under the Presidential Palace, in Santiago. In the visual arts, the National Bellas Artes Museum just opened a photography show looking at migration in the Americas. It is a photographic record of a 40-week trip that Dutch photojournalist Kadir van Loewiesen took in 2011 and 2012. He traveled the full length of the Pan-American Highway, covering 28,000 kilometers in 15 countries. The project was funded by crowdsourcing in 2011 and includes an iPad application.
Een ijsdrukker is iemand die de Dalton Highway opgaat en zorgt dat hij niet zo druk in de brak rijdt.
Many Santiaguinos escape the summer heat by taking vacations on the coast. If you follow them to the port city of Valparaiso, February 5, you can catch the opening night of Rocódromo. It's a six-day music festival. The opening event will have a series of bands playing from various balconies around a plaza. The audience will be spread out in the plaza and up the steep hill next to it. Camilo Eque, a young singer-songwriter from southern Chile, is among those who will be playing. One part of the festival will be the launch of a new book by critic Manuel Mayra. It's called Songs at the End of the World and includes interviews with well-known Chilean performers such as Anita Tijoux and Francisca Valenzuela. The launch party will have live music from Denver. If you choose to go even farther afield to southern Chile, you'll find an open sculpture workshop in the city of Valdivia. The Valdivia Cultural Center is hosting sculptors from Mexico, Brazil, Uruguay, and Chile who will build large-scale works in marble, wood, and metal over the course of 10 days in a couple large warehouses. The whole process is open to the public and runs from February 5 to 15. For Monocle in Santiago, this is Stephen Bodson.
Nice sounds in that. You are listening to The Review live from Studio One at Midori House on Monocle 24. We're going to speak to Matt Wolfe about theatre right now.
Exactly, because we are rounding our show off today by turning our attention to theatre. And while Broadway takes its time, getting into January, London takes a running jump at the season with several new and noteworthy productions already underway. And two of them have brought that old question to the forefront once more: can stars of the screen do well on stage?
And here to give his opinion and to explain why New York and London are working to different clocks, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Monocle's regular theatre man, and the International Herald Tribune's It's a big old introduction. It's Matt Wolf, everybody.
That's better, isn't it?
That sounds good to me, Rob.
Sometimes I felt like I had a mouthful of sand there for a second.
No, you do.
Welcome to
panache.
The show.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
And he comes in brandishing programmes. I think he's been to the theatre. It's okay. We're on safe ground.
No, I just go in and buy them and leave.
Old Times is the first thing that you've got there, Matt.
Yeah.
This is something that we previewed a few weeks ago, actually. We had a brief chat. Now we can review.
Yeah, it's so nice. I saw it twice. And in fact, the critics were encouraged to see it twice. I don't know whether punters will or not. It all depends on budgets. I would recommend it if you want to splash out, because the two wonderful actresses in it, Kristen Scott Thomas and Leah Williams, are alternating in the two female roles, Rufus Sewell incomparable in the one male role. So he has to absorb these women as they do their shifts. And it's really two different plays. That's not quite fair. It's two variations on a theme, fascinating variations on a theme. It's about a husband and a wife living in English quasi-isolation. And the wife is visited by her best friend from 20 years before, who we are led to believe at the beginning the husband has never met. But actually, as this is by Harold Pinter, master of the enigmatic. Mm-hmm. So things are not necessarily what they seem. It turns out that not only might the husband have met her, but he might in fact have had a rather intimate acquaintanceship with her. It's not necessarily even clear that all the characters are alive at the particular moment that we're watching them, that they might not be some sort of phantasm in the husband's mind. It's really fascinating. It's very sexy. It's very mysterious. It's intriguing. It's done straight through 80 minutes, so you're out before 9 o'clock. And
all your dinner lovers.
No time for a glass of wine.
Yeah, exactly. Well before last orders.
Yes, exactly. And is it a traditional staging of this play? It's a Pinter play from the early 70s.
Yeah, it was written in 1971, and it can be done with an interval. It can be done without. It's usually done as a sort of dreamscape. There was a production of it at the Donmar Warehouse in Covent Garden about a decade or so ago, directed by Roger Michell, who does a lot of movies. And he staged the whole thing behind a gauze scrim, the idea being that you were looking at it through the filter of memory. This has a little bit of that, but not much. You are in the room with these people, but it's very bare, it's very sparse, very beautiful. There are two distinct sets, the second one being the bedroom, the other one being the living room. But it's essence of space rather than lots of stuff. The focus is really on the actresses and of course, Rufus. What's interesting is Leah Williams and Kristen Scott Thomas, having seen them both play both roles, they don't play the roles in the same way. So when you see Kristen Scott Thomas as the wife, she's very cool, rather knowing, very transfixing. When Leah Williams then plays the wife, she's much more agitated, very sad, rather haunted. And it's wonderful because it makes you realize that there are infinitely many ways to play the same text if you've got talented people.
Well, we saw the swapping of the roles in Frankenstein at the National Theatre, where it's fascinating to see how an actor can run with the interpretation of the same words, the same lines, the same character. And I think it's quite clever on the stage to invite the audience to get more involved in the play and the interpretation.
I think that's absolutely right. And of course, it's a very clever producing gambit, because what you're basically saying as the producer of the event is you have enough confidence in this show to invite your public, potentially, of course they don't have to, but potentially to see it twice. It also throws the microscope very directly on the work. And one of the things that happened with Frankenstein was people said, well, great to see John Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch, you know, do these two parts. But actually, the script's not all that great. With this one, I think a lot of us felt after the second viewing of it, gosh, is there a reason we can go back and see it a third time?
Yeah.
Because the more you see it, the more details you notice, the more there is to unravel. I really have to give a shout out to Rufus Sewell, because he's quite dazzling, having to do something the most actors don't have to do. Normally, when you're in a play, you know, Rob, Gillian, you're playing your part, you're playing your part. That's it. I speak to you as you and you as you. But if you were to switch in the next 3 seconds, yeah, I would be very disoriented. Yeah.
I'd look good in Gillian's clothes. Yeah. on that bombshell, we've got to move quickly on because we've only got a couple of minutes. I think we've got about a minute and a half now, unfortunately. But we've got to mention Rowan Atkinson, Simon Gray's Quatermain's terms. You're making a face, Matt.
Well, I'm only following Mr. Atkinson's lead. Where Mr. Atkinson leads, I happily follow. No, brave. I mean, you know, Kristen Scott Thomas has now done, what is it, 4 or 5 shows on the West End. They've all been very successful to some degree or other. Rowan Atkinson, of course, known for his cinema persona, wonderful in in the opening ceremony of the Olympics, but he's not really a stage actor if you have to submerge yourself into a part. And in this, he's still playing variations on Mr. Bean and his various celluloid personae, and it's not really right for the part of a teacher at a Cambridge school. Doesn't do it.
Oh, well, I'm sorry we've got to leave it there. We really have.
I want to talk more about
it. Thank you, though, for reading my inexpert hand signals and winding
pleasure,
up
Rob.
So quickly.
A pleasure.
As ever, Matt Wolf, thank you very much for joining us. And that brings us to the end of the Saturday Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Bilbur, with help from David Michon. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. We're handing over to Georgina with the Weekend Edition next, where you can catch up on all the best of Monocle 24. It's time to go.